Hello and welcome to A Response to Bidet. My name is Gideon Rothstein, and I am going to be your host for discussing a response for the second day of Adar Bet. Adar Bet 2, this is going to be a discussion on the Sri De'ish of Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg about a husband whose wife has gone insane. We start by thanking the OU, Rabbi Jacob Ramwitz, and David Hachhauser for all they do in putting the Shirim out there and making them available to you. And we are going to be looking at Shut Sri De'ish, the first volume, Chilek Aleph, first part, Simon Sadi Hey, response number 95. And I guess I think that a good piece of background to start with is a reminder that we should remember that divorce is almost always a very sad and unfortunate event, maybe always, but sometimes it's a necessary event, and sometimes it's a necessary event that both sides realize is necessary, and it's not a question of, oh, you know, I remember years ago a friend of mine told me he was an important rough, but he also went to law school, and he said when they learned marital law in the class, the woman who came in to give the class said, there's always two sides to divorce. There's her side, and then there's used a bad word for the husband's side, right? So, right, because he's always wrong. Sometimes she's wrong. But sometimes neither side is wrong. That's the important thing. Sometimes both sides recognize neither side is wrong. So a classic example, not our example today, but a classic example would be in times when business travel was legitimately dangerous, and when sometimes men were lost in their business travel, and the bodies weren't found, or were found, and there were all sorts of problems identifying the body. So that creates many, many tshuvot of igun, of a classic igun, where there's a woman who, through nobody's fault or anybody's fault, as far as we know, the husband loved the wife loved the husband, we have her problem. So one of the things that we've seen a tshuva like this, one of the things that husbands did sometimes was, they would give their wife a get all tonight, they would give their wife a divorce on the condition that, in that case, the condition would be something like, if I don't return within, you know, if I'm going on a two-month trip, if I don't return within 6 months, you're divorced. Now, for a Kohen to do that is a little dangerous, because if he doesn't make it back, she's divorced. And then if he's just delayed, he can never get remarried again. And that's the tshuva that we saw some other time. But fundamentally, there are times when divorce is for the benefit of everybody involved. The case would be if a man is sadly about to pass away and they don't have any children, and he wants to help his wife not have to go through Yibam or Chalitza, that would be another situation. So in our tshuva, in Sri De'ish, Chelek Aleph Siman Sadi Hey, it's not going to be a divorce situation, because he's not going to be able to divorce the wife. Why is he not going to be able to divorce the wife? Because she has sadly gone insane. So this is the tshuva that's brought to him. This is before the war. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, was the last, I think the English word is rector, and basically the last Rosh Yeshiva of the Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer in the 1800s had set up a rabbinic seminary in Berlin that lasted till the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. And the last head of that was Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who later, after the war, moved to Switzerland, and then wrote, or maybe during the war, but he survived the war, went to Switzerland, and lived the rest of his life in Montreux, Switzerland, and he wrote Sri De'ish. So this response was dated from the second Adarsh of Adar Sheni, of Tafresh, that he writes it as Tafresh Sadiqat. I think we've come to custom since then not to write it that way, because Tafresh Sadiqat is a Hebrew word, spells out a Hebrew word that means murder, and people say, oh, 1938, people already, that's what the year was. But he wrote it that way as if it wasn't an issue. But from then, from 1938, the second half of their bet, so there are issues looming on the horizon, but they're still having these kinds of questions. Here's the question. So there's a man living in Lodz, Poland. He marries his wife in 1924. Now they're already asking the question in 1938. But, and they give the name, and the year they got married, they had a daughter. Okay, so the daughter now, by the time they're asking him this question, is a 14-year-old girl. So these things sometimes take a lot of time, and I've always noticed that in Shavuot, how people's lives sort of go on and on and on as these issues are working their way through the halachic process, halachic system, and they're sort of stuck. So she went insane. This is not the husband claiming it. Everybody agrees. She's in the hospital. Now, I don't know what the level of quality of the treatment of the insane was in Poland at the time, but this is what the story is. And we have good reason to think, we have, they quote, a rabbi gone, whoever it is, they don't name, but they quote some important rabbi, they think it was important, saying the doctors say that they don't know of any way to heal her, to help her, and she's just going to be there, as far as they can tell, forever. And her relatives have agreed that they can support her. They have a family trust, a family inheritance, and she has a share of the inheritance, and therefore they say they can support her. So that seems to be all being handled in a fully appropriate fashion, and nobody's fighting about anything. Now, the husband has agreed to raise the daughter, which didn't sound like a great agreement, like such a sacrifice on his part, but he's raising the daughter. But now, he wants... So this is 14 years later, so I don't know how come it could be so urgent, but it seems to be he wants the right to get married again. And a lot of reasons people want to get married again. They want company. He wants somebody to help raise the daughter. He wants maybe to be able to fulfill his mitzvah, right? He got married at a young age, married this woman, they had a daughter, and then that's it. He wants to be able to have a second child, and this time maybe a son, to fulfill the mitzvah of procreation. So it happens to be there's a long tradition, and this is something people complain about because it is a clear imbalance in how we handle problems that come up on the husband's side as opposed to the wife's side. In the husband's case, and I'm not getting into that, I'm just pointing it out, I'm not ignoring it, but in the husband's case, there is a long-standing tradition that, first, Torah law says you could theoretically divorce a woman against her will, except that in this case he couldn't because even against the woman's will, if the divorce is going to happen, the woman has to understand what the get is and how the get works. If the woman is insane, then we can't trust that she understands what the get is and what the get does, and therefore, she technically, legally, the get cannot be valid. That being true, the husband is stuck in this case, even in a Torah law situation. But since in many other cases, the woman just refused to accept the get, by Torah law, he could have forced her to take the get. Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom, the set of rules that came about, that first of all, said men should marry two wives, right? That Torah law, men could marry two wives. So in this case, the husband wouldn't have a problem, he'd just marry a second wife. But Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom, that set of rules that came about, said A, the husband can't divorce her against her will, and B, he can't have two wives. It also said, I think he can't open other people's mail. There's all sorts of things that came along, but those are the well-known parts of Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom. But along with that, the custom became, when it became to be understood, that if he gets the agreement of 100 rabbis in three different lands, it's supposed to be, so that's the Heter Merib, and that's how it's known. In addition to which, if he leaves with a court the value of her ketubah, the amount of money that he would have owed her if they actually got divorced, plus the nedunya, whatever financial property she brought to the marriage, in halacha, the way we don't really, most of us don't pay close attention to this anymore, but in those times, for sure you'd have an nedunya. The nedunya was the amount the wife brought into the marriage. Whatever she brought into the marriage, if the marriage ended, she was supposed to get that amount back straight up. And then also a ketubah, also the additional support of the ketubah. He, in halacha, if he's going to divorce her, is supposed to leave all of those amounts of money with the court and also guarantee that he'll pay her mizonot until such time as she accepts the get. Right, if there comes a time, so if it's a case of coercing her, if it's a case of she's refusing to accept the get, it's until she accepts the get, he'll give her the mizonot that she wants, that she deserves till then, or in this case, until she gets better. Now, the mizonot are not an issue, and the money for her medical care is not an issue because the family has agreed they're going to take care of it. That's not the issue at hand. But the practice is he has to leave a ketubah in the dunya. Now, when it comes to the dunya, he claims that he never got anything from the wife's family, they never brought anything to the marriage because the husband, the father of the bride had promised her something. He had promised her a chedek in the Yerusha, a share of, you know, whatever inheritance there was. Then she had already gone insane by the time they passed away, and that inheritance was never separated and given to him, and that's being used now for her purposes. So he claims that he doesn't owe that at all. There is no such thing. And then he's also very poor, and he can't pay a ketubah payment. He doesn't have the money to do it. So it sounds like her family is a little wealthier than his family, but he can't pay. So the question is, what can we do for this guy? Now, it's not that the family is coming with a financial claim. That's not the issue. Her family seems not to care about the money. They have the money to support her, and that's fine from their perspective. The question is, the practice is not to allow a husband to marry a second wife, which is a violation of Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom, which is an ignoring of this set of practices that came out. I think historians think that it wasn't actually Rabbeinu Gershom. I think they'll find evidence of it till later, like 200 years later, in the time of, or 150 years later, in the time of the Tosafot. Whatever it is, it's a practice that became accepted by and incumbent upon Jews, and that practice included the idea that before the husband can marry a second wife, he would have to take care of these financial issues. So what are we going to do? So the questioner wanted to know if you could realize, he found the Maharam Padua and others who said that what he could do when he doesn't have the money is that he can just leave promissory notes. He can be mashdi shtarot. He can leave with the beit din promissory notes that say, yes, I owe this money and whatever. Because after all, if you owe somebody money, you owe the money and they can collect it and they work on the collection or whatever it is. And he can do that and then start the process. And maybe by the time she gets better, he can pay it off. He'll be able to pay it off. Or maybe she'll never get better and he'll never have to pay it off. Whatever it is. But then that was Maharam Padua thought you could do that. Then he pointed out that he has an uncle, the man writing the letter, who was a Rav in Mir, who said that there's at the end of the Shas Vilna, at the end of the Vambolt, there's a Hagaha of the Orzarua. It says that when we say Meir Abanim, usually we say they have to be in three lands, right? And they speak three languages. But he says that in a tough situation, you can even use it from the same land who all speak the same language. So if that's true, And we have another 100, and that also seems to imply that the rules of a Heter Merabonim are not absolute, they're not completely strict, and therefore, if there's a situation where you cannot fulfill all the rules, you have the right to follow a lesser rule. That's the question. So now, what does the Sri Deish say in response? So first he says, I think there's some issues here that we have to think about, because the people who say that you can rely, there was a rush they were going to rely on to say that you can get away without actually paying the money or leaving the money with the Beit Din. But the Sri Deish says, I don't understand. The rush happens to hold that even in the time of the Gemara, you could get divorced even if you didn't have the money for the ketubah and then just owe it to her. Meaning, man wants to get divorced, and let's suppose, as was usually the case at the time of the Gemara, that it was the man who wanted to get divorced and the woman didn't want to get divorced. I'm not saying that's the way it should be, but in the times of the Gemara, let's say when women were economically disadvantaged and all sorts of things, when they were married, they wanted to stay married, and the husband seems to have decided he wanted to get divorced, so he wants to get divorced. But the Chachamim had set up this rule that he had to pay off a ketubah. Now, those who hold that ketubah is all right, that it's a Torah required payment. I think we generally assume that it's a rabbinically required payment. So the reason in the Gemara that Chazal set up that payment was that it shouldn't be simple and casual for him to divorce her, because Chazal were clearly worried that men would mistreat women and discard them casually. So that the ketubah was there to protect the woman. That being true, well, what if the husband wants to divorce her but doesn't have the money right now? So the rush said, it doesn't matter. Now, how the rush got there is not our issue, but that was the rush's opinion. The rush's opinion was, it sets up a continuing loan and an obligation, and he'll have to pay it off, and then whatever the procedures are for collecting debts will apply to that payment as well. But the divorce can happen. And that opinion is quoted in the Rambam in Eben Ezra, but that's not the end of the story. So if we follow that opinion, then in this case it should be okay as well, that even though the husband doesn't have the money to divorce her, he'll be able to leave a get with the court, and then the money will become an obligation. But in Koshin Mishpat and the Beit Shmuel on Eben Ezer, they quote a tshuva of the Rashba, who says, no, you can't get divorced without a ketubah. And he points out that his proof, the Rashba's support, was from Gemara Ketubot Nun Aleph Amen Aleph. So it happens to be that Chazal, another financial obligation that Chazal set up, was that they required the husband to pay for illnesses, for her care, her medical care, and it's part of one of the conditions of the marriage that they set up, and he gets something in return for that. I forget what, not Masay Adab, but he gets something in return for that from her, right? So they gave Kim some financial right that ordinarily would have been hers in return for the fact that if she ever gets ill, he'll be her health insurance, as it were. So a lot of these financial arrangements are not observed strictly today, and that's a whole set of questions that come up in our time. But when we're looking at the model that Chazal set up in Ketubot, in the Gemara, they said he's obligated to pay her refuah. But in that particular instance, if she became seriously ill, nobody's recommended they should handle this. This is just about, you know, when we talk about financial obligations and rules, the question is, what are we going to make a rule about? So the Gemara says that if she gets ill and it's a long-term illness and he can't afford it, or he doesn't know how to afford it, and he were to say, okay, I'm going to have to divorce her, and here's her ketubah, he's allowed to do that. But the Rashi says, clear from that, that means he's actually paying the ketubah, because otherwise, why would they allow that, right? If his obligation right now is to pay for her medical care, and then he says, I don't have the money for her medical care, but he says, here's the ketubah, and I'm not paying that either, then he hasn't helped her at all. So that's the way the Rashba understood it. So for the Rashba, it seems very clear that you have to give her the money. So the question becomes, according to whom do we rule? And that's not so clear. If we rule like the Rush, if we follow the Rush's view that the monetary payment is separate from the act of divorce, then presumably here, where she's insane, where she's not in her right mind, she's unable to, you know, function, then he could leave the divorce with the court and owe the money and then pay it at a future time, as the Rush would have allowed when she was a fully healthy woman. He would have allowed that. But then, according to the Rashba, who says you have to pay at the time, seems to require paying at the time of divorce, then here too, you'd seem to have to pay at the time of divorce. But the Beit Shmuel, the Sri Deish now points out, the Beit Shmuel there adds that if he can, if he has the right to divorce her al pi din Torah, meaning even if the Torah recognizes the reason he's giving for the divorce. There are lots of reasons for divorces. Some of those reasons are just reasons. The Torah is not going to get in the way of people wanting to divorce. Meaning, let's say two people came to court and said, we want to get divorced. The court said, why? And they said, spite, right? They said, spite. And then the court said, well, that's not a valid halakhic reason just for spite. Right? They want to, we want to spike the halakha because we want to show that. I remember many years ago reading about some husband and wife who didn't like the divorce laws. I don't know why. In America, not a Jewish thing at all. And they decided to get divorced and remarried. They set some Guinness Book of World Records, the number of times they got divorced and remarried. So let's say the kids go, it's a first spite. We want to pay the money. We want to show what a silly system the halakhic system is and show what gerushin looks like, show what divorce looks like. So we're not happy about that in halakha, but I don't think we would stop them because fundamentally, if a husband and wife get divorced, I think they discourage them and try to think about it, but if a husband and wife want to get divorced, they get divorced in halakha. But there are other reasons where the Torah says, no, that's a good reason to get divorced. Let's say the husband comes in and says, you know, I think my wife's having an affair, I can't prove it, and I'm willing to pay the ketubah payment, but I can't live with her anymore because I really think that she's having, having affairs around me and whatever. So that might be a din Torah reason to get divorced. So the Beit Shmuel said, if there are din Torah reasons to get divorced, then he thinks the Rashba would even agree that the fact that the man can't pay the ketubah right now would not be a reason to stop, that she would have to accept the divorce even if the man can't currently pay the ketubah. And based on that, and the reasons, which the Rashi doesn't fully quote, Rav Yitzchok called an inspector, and Shut Ein Yitzchok also wrote that you can, if the woman has lost her mind, and she is unfortunately not in her right mind, you can leave a divorce for her, even if you can't pay off the ketubah, based on this Beit Shmuel, that where there's a good reason to get divorced, that her no longer being in her right mind. Now there, it's impossible for her to get divorced, as I said before, because she doesn't understand the get process, but it would be a good reason to get divorced because he's without a spouse. And in halacha, let's remember, halachically, the Torah really thinks that men and women should have spouses. It's not a woman-men issue. They think that people should be married. So if one of the partners in the marriage really can't function, our goal would be to help the other one find a way to get married. It's much harder, as I said before, and don't want to skip over that. It's not a small matter. It's much harder for the woman in that situation, and there are many, many tshuvot that try to help women in situations where they're stuck, but that's the story. So therefore, the Ein Yitzchok held that you could follow that even according to the Rashba, you could leave not the money and just the get in a situation where she's lost her mind. Shridi Eish isn't so sure. Right? That would be reason to support the view. But Shridi Eish says, I'm not so sure, because if you look at the Beit Shmuel in that situation, it's about where she has something terribly, terribly wrong with her that leads to us to say that the husband could divorce her at a Torah level. The example is a Baalat Nichba. She has epilepsy, which was for a long, long time was a terrible, terrible disease, and completely incurable, and completely destroyed any quality of life. I think today they have better treatments for it. But I still remember when I was going for my driving test, which was a bunch of years ago already, more years ago than I'd care to think about, but it's not 100 years ago. I want to guarantee that. The one condition that made you completely unable to get a driver's license, I think it must have been total blindness was also a condition, but they didn't talk about that. Maybe they said, other than legal blindness, one condition that made you completely unable to drive, otherwise you could get cars, you could fix it up, was epilepsy. Right, so I think today they have somewhat better drugs for it and better medication for it, caring for it. But in the time, it was a good example of the time of the Beit Shmuel of a boom, of a problem with her that was intractable, and you couldn't do anything about it. You couldn't expect somebody to have to work with it and stay with it. So therefore, he can divorce her and add a situation, and she can accept the get. So since she's obligated to accept the get because she has some problem with her that means the marriage is really completely unworkable, she has to accept the get. So there, you can say that paying off the ketubah is like a debt, like in any situation. But where she's no longer in her right mind, you can't say, as I said before, you can't say she's obligated to accept the get because she doesn't have any obligations. She's a shotat. Not only is she not obligated, she actually can't physically do it. So then it might be that when we're going to sort of end the marriage without her knowing about it, without her realizing it, and against her will, maybe there we do require that you have to leave the ketubah. Maybe all of this discussion is not fully relevant. So the Sri Deish is saying, I hear the halakhic reason that people are advancing. They rely on the Rosh, and even when they're not relying on the Rosh, they rely on the Rosh plus, they say, well, if she's insane, it's sort of something not so different from when she has epilepsy. And there, the Beit Shmuel and Vizkal Inspector, important halachic authorities, held that even the Rashba would agree. So says Rav Yehesh, I think that's different because in epilepsy there's an actual get and an actual divorce process, and therefore, since she's obligated to accept the get, you could say that's an obligation, and that obligation is separate from the financial realities. You'll take care of the finances later. Whereas in our case, there's not going to be a get, right? You're going to leave a get for her. But as long as she's not in her right mind, she can't accept the get. So you're going to leave the get for her. So when is she going to accept the get? She's going to accept the get only if God willing. If something wonderful and miraculous happens and she gets better, that's when she'll accept the get. But the truth is, he says by that time, she's not really obligated to accept the get because she could say, well, I'm better now. I would like to continue the marriage. Now, it happens to be since he's going to be married to somebody else, he's not going to want to continue the marriage. And therefore, it's not like we're going to say to him, nope, you have to stay married to this woman. She's going to get divorced or she's going to be required to get divorced. But at that time, why should she have to accept the divorce without the money? She should be able to get the money right away because we possibly, like the Rashba, that you can't require a woman to get divorced. Whether we seem to probably practice the rest, you can't require a woman to get divorced if she doesn't get the money at the same time. So now the Shadish says the truth is the whole thing is kind of odd. Why are we leaving a get for her? The whole idea that we have to leave a get plus a ketubah for her just sitting there, he says it's very strange because we're leaving the get and we're not going to give it to her until she gets better. And when she gets better, you think that she could get divorced without the ketubah because I apologize. I said before we follow the Rashba. He's saying actually in that situation he thinks we don't follow the Rashba. We follow the Rush and the Rivash, who say you're allowed to get divorced without a ketubah, which then should mean his whole question didn't start. Anyway, he's struggling with this because at that point he could get, meaning he's saying, I think now that she's not able to accept the get, maybe we don't follow the Rush because you have this Rashba saying no situation shouldn't do it. But now he's going around saying, but by the time she gets the get, then she'd be able to just say, well, we'll follow the Rush to that situation. Why do we have a problem at all? So he says he thinks the issue is the question of being kala le'elohotiyah. He thinks that's why the Rashba held the way he did. If you don't give the ketubah, and you're not going to have to pay her food anymore because she's divorced, you're going to have a financial incentive to get rid of her, the husband, and we don't want that. We want it to be a big deal for him financially to divorce a wife. And so in the case of where's the Rush holds, this is the Rush holds that as long as that he hasn't finished paying off her ketubah, he has to continue supporting her with mizonot. So the Rush thinks that this is somewhat similar to today's halachic prenuptial agreements that the RCA has. Right? The halachic prenuptial agreement that the RCA has is that until you have a Jewish divorce, you pay mizonot. Part of why it's seen as more halachically valid is exactly this idea. You have a Rush who says that for as long as there hasn't been a divorce, the Rush even goes further. For as long as there hasn't been a payment of the ketubah, as long as the financial agreement hasn't been completely done, he has to pay her mizonot, he has to support her. So that's why you understand it's not kala b'nevlotzia, but the Rashba held that that you stop, that the obligation in mizonot and support stops as soon as he has divorced her. So that's why there's a problem. That's why you'd say, no, he has to pay the ketubah. So if you're going to connect them to each other, it seems like with a woman who's gone insane, that you'd have to leave the ketubah because maybe he won't have the support for her. And then we said that when he can't support her, continuing to support her, then even the Rush should theoretically agree that she has to pay the ketubah. In our case, he doesn't have to give her the mizonot because the relatives of the wife are saying they're paying the mizonot. So he's not paying anything continuingly, says the Sri Deish. It would seem like we should follow the opinion that he has to leave the ketubah with her. Not because we don't follow the Rush, as I said before, that was a mistake of mine and I apologize, but because the Rush's willingness to let him not pay off the ketubah right away was based on the fact the Rush held that you have to give her mizonot all along until you pay the ketubah. But in our situation, since he's not going to be paying mizonot, then it would seem like you have to leave the ketubah. And there's a couple of other permutations of what is allowed and not allowed in these situations. The question was, why wouldn't he just leave her the support? Although in our situation, that wouldn't matter because the family is agreeing to support her, but they say because you don't know how much it is. So then he points out, I think, Chelkat Mechokek, who says, I don't understand the whole situation. If she's not in her right mind, then why are you leaving a ketubah if he's got to pay her all the other mamon stuff? He says he thinks that the answer is that the point is that everything should be ready for her when she's ready to accept her get if she gets better. So if that's true, then even though the relatives are paying for her medicine and her food and her support, but if there's an obligation of a ketubah, the practice is he has to leave everything for her. So if he actually has to leave everything for her, it would seem like he has to leave everything for her. Except that, as he says, what's more, so if you hold that way, then it's supposed to be all ready for her, and that's the takana, then it is. But the Shri Deish seems to think, but I don't understand, once she's better, why couldn't she just follow the Rush and then be required to come to court and get it? So then he quotes a Tzemach Tzedek with Simon Samach Zion. And this, I think it's the old Tzemach Tzedek, meaning there was a Tzemach Tzedek who lived before, like early on, like the 1500s. And then there was a Tzemach Tzedek, one of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, one of the early Lubavitcher Rebbe. I think the second or the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, or fourth maybe, was a Tzemach Tzedek, and also a very important Meshi. But I think this is the early Tzemach Tzedek. And he said, you know what? Let the relatives in these situations where everybody's agreed that you want the divorce to happen, or the, not that you want it to happen, but that you understand that that's what has to happen, and the relatives don't seem to be fighting him on anything in this situation, They say, let them sell the ketubah to the husband, meaning the ketubah is a financial right of hers. Let them act on her behalf, sell the ketubah to the husband, b'tuvat hana'av, which is a very small amount, for the right to decide who gets the eventual money of the ketubah. So once the husband owns it, he'll have the right to decide who gets the ketubah. He'll presumably decide that he'll get it, and then he'll be okay. But the tuvat hana'av, a ketubah, is much less than the actual value of the ketubah, because it's just the right to decide who gets it. Meaning, let's say a woman came to you, let's say anybody came to you and said, listen, I have the right to assign $100,000, a possible $100,000 in the future, to whoever I want. Because why is it possible? Because it only gets paid off if they actually get divorced, and that'll only happen if she gets better, or if he dies first. Right? So it's not an actual $100,000. How much would you pay for the possible future right for $100,000? That's an interesting question, but it's certainly a lot less than $100,000, unless the man's on his deathbed, then it's very close to $100,000. So you have futures markets. That's basically what she's doing. So the Tzemach Tzedek said, let her sell the futures right to the husband, and then he'll pay the lesser amount, but and then when the ketubah comes due, now, if they're staying married, you're not allowed to do such a thing, because that's not the point of the ketubah. The whole point of the ketubah was it should be financially problematic for the husband to divorce her. That's and it should be a financial penalty for him. But here in this situation, since they're not staying married anyway, that's what the Tzemach Tzedek suggested. In our case, if you could do that, that would be good. Now, the problem with that is that when you sell something on somebody else's behalf, we're usually not allowed to do that without their specific consent, right? Because in halacha, we say, Zachin adam shelo b'fanav, I can acquire something for you, not by paying for it. Meaning, if someone wants to give you a gift, and I take it on your behalf, we say, yes, I can do that. Because we assume that gaining a possession is almost always a benefit to a person, and I won't object to it, and therefore I can do it even without your specific consent. But where it's an issue, where we can't be absolutely positive that it's a benefit for you. So, for example, let's say I hear of the greatest investment in the world. As far as I know, you give me $1,000 now, and I pay you $2,000 tomorrow. Can I take somebody else's $1,000, put the money in the pot for the $2,000, and it's a sure thing. Everything's a sure thing. It's 100% guaranteed. Can I take the $1,000, put it in, and then expect the $2,000 tomorrow for that person? The answer, I think, is that we generally say no, because zachin ladam shelo b'fanav ve'in chavin ladam. We can't do something that is, even in the short term, a negative for you without your consent. So here, they're selling her ketubah. Now, at least in theory, we're selling the ketubah for $2,000, and his ketubah would have paid off at $100,000. So truthfully, it's a benefit to her because she's getting the money now, and she can, from the Tzemach Tzedek said, and from the money she's getting now, she can support herself somewhat, and she can get mezonot. Otherwise, she would have nothing, basically. So that's why it's a benefit for her. But the Tzidkiyah says, in our situation, she's already been guaranteed all that support that the Tzemach Tzedek was talking about. I mean, Tzemach Tzedek was talking about, let's say you have a situation, husband and wife are going to get divorced for whatever reason. He doesn't have the money to pay off the ketubah, but he wants to get divorced, and she's going to have nothing, basically, unless they get divorced. So if you sell him the ketubah for the tovat hana'ah, she'll at least get money to be supported. And that's a reason why she'll say she'll prefer it. It's unclear that we accept that Tzemach Tzedek, but in our situation, it's not even quite as good because she doesn't need that money for the support, since she has her share of the father's Yerusha, the father's inheritance. Nonetheless, says the Tzidkiyah, and by the way, Chassid Sofer wasn't so sure that he agreed with that whole idea, that whole line of reasoning, but he says, because we had, as we've seen before, the Beit Shmuel and the Yitzchak Reitz Chaim Prospector, who said you could allow it to keep for their reasons, right, in terms of when she get better, and you, then you're not worried about that he's going to divorce her too casually in all those situations. So therefore, he thought, the Tzidkiyah thought, there was room here to say that we could, if we added this Tzemach Tzedek, that the husband will pay the tovas hana'ah, the right, the amount it would take to sell it for the right to assign the money to whoever so wanted, right? So which would be that much, that's that future right to the ketubah. Then he thinks that there's room to say you could do it. Now, if he's completely unable to do it, and the krovim and the relatives don't want to actually give him over the right to ketubah, I mean, they want that if she gets better, that she'll get her full ketubah. So I think there might be room to be mekel anyway. Now, all that was in terms of ketubah and paying it off or not. But there's also the nedunya question. The nedunya question was that normally he has to pay back all the money she brought into the marriage, and he's claiming that she didn't bring any money to the marriage because the father just said, listen, I'm going to go soon, and there's going to be the share of this reasonably sizable inheritance. You get a share of that when the time comes. So there are people that said, if you leave like a completely certified promissory note, basically, and that says you owe that money, You could leave it. And then there were others who held the Maran Padua had quoted the Gaon Milisa, who's the Chavas Das, Rav Yaakov Leuberbaum, who all pointed out that when it comes to the ketubah, and leaving it with the court on her behalf. That was said very clearly in the original takana, the original ordinance, but then the dinya wasn't mentioned as explicitly, and therefore in cases where the husband's in really a hard situation, you can leave that aside and leave the nedunya question. If she ever gets better and starts to command her nedunya, then you'll go to court and have to litigate it. But for now, you can leave it and let him get divorced. Let him leave the get for her, even without paying that off, since he claims there is no obligation to pay it off because he says he never got it. So fundamentally, the Sri Deish is willing to say that we can let her, we can let the husband get divorced, even though he can't pay the ketubah, even though he says it's in a dunya, even though he can't even buy it that he prefers, he would pay off at least the rights to the you know, the future's right to the ketubah. He would prefer that, but if he can't do that, then he's willing to go forego that. So fundamentally, this situation where you want the man to be able to get remarried, so we'll do what we can to be able to help the man get remarried. There are plenty of other situations for those who might be worried about it. I think there are plenty of other situations where post-game work very hard to let women in such situations, such as the husband disappeared, where you find, sadly, a body that's not fully identifiable as a husband by ordinary halakhic standards, and they also work in those situations to help the woman. This happens to be a case where we saw Sri Deish on the second day of Adar, Sheni of Shnat Tafresh Bet Sadi of 1938, trying to help a husband whose wife could no longer live with him as a wife. He's been around for 14 years now and apparently has been unable to be with him as wife, and trying to find a way to let him find his way to some kind of a married life. So we'll hope that all of us have happy married lives, don't get these situations, and can live full lives without needing the support of such great gedolim as the Sri Deish. With thanks to the OU, Trevor Jacob Roberts, David Hockhauser, this has been a responsible day for the second day of Adar Sheni. Have a great day.